Well, why don't we just start by having you introduce yourself for us?
Okay. My name is Forrest Dunbar, and I'm a nominee for U.S. Congress.
Okay.
You're a Democrat, right?
I am, yes. I won the Democratic nomination.
Okay. Why don't you give us a little bit about your background? You grew up here in Alaska?
Right. So I grew up in a little town called Eagle on the Yukon River until I was seven. And sometimes people mistake it for Eagle River, but it's Eagle. Very different community. And then when I was seven, we moved to Cordova on Prince William Sound. My dad was a fisheries biologist with Fish and Game, and my mom was a special ed teacher. And today she's a librarian, and they still live there. They live for about 10 years in Fairbanks after I finished high school, but they have moved back to Cordova. And I myself live in Anchorage now, so I've lived in a lot of different places in the state.
Have you been to Juneau before?
Yes. I actually lived here for a session 2 years ago. I'd visited a couple times before that. I was here. I wasn't a session aide, but I was working on policy for an executive agency. I was here for that time, and then I've been coming down during the campaign several times as well. Before the session, my most distinct memory of Juneau was when I was five or six. We came down here. I might have even been younger. And I just remember it because I had a stuffed snake, and the cleaning lady at our hotel took it and put it through the wash and turned it from a red snake to a pink snake. I remember this very distinctly.
Was it a sad moment?
It was. It was very upsetting for a five-year-old version of me.
All right. So, and previous government experience?
I worked on the Hill. I was an intern for Frank Murkowski when I was very young, 17. And then I went to school in D.C., and I was an intern and a paid staffer for a Democratic congresswoman named Madeline Bordalio. I also did some other work. I worked at a place called the Brookings Institution for a little while. I worked at D.C. Public Schools for a little while. These were usually summer sort of fellowship opportunities.
When you say you went to school in D.C., was your undergrad?
Yes, I went to American University. I studied economics and international relations.
All right. And eventually made you, or when did you choose the Democratic Party and why?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't consider myself particularly partisan. Like I said before, my first job in politics, internship was for a Republican. When I was here during session, I worked very closely with a number of Republicans. And I believe that good ideas can come from either side of the aisle. However, my parents were both Democrats. And I think that is actually the single largest predictor of which party you align with is what your parents were. Also, on a number of issues, I'm closer to the Democratic Party. I'm opposed to the Ryan budget, for example, which is the sort of central organizing document of the House Republicans that cuts Medicaid and turns Medicare into a voucher program and that Don Young, my opponent, voted for. That kind of economic policy that cuts those middle-class programs and then takes that money and puts it into things like capital gains tax cuts, that's something that doesn't really align with me. And I certainly want taxes to be as low as possible, but not at the cost of Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. Also, on some social issues, you know, I am pro-choice, and women's health is something that matters a lot to me. I was opposed to the Hobby Lobby decision. That's another place where I differ with Don Young. He was very passionately in support of giving bosses the right to choose whether or not their employees get contraception, which to me seems a little bit remarkable. And the last thing I'll say is my sister happens to be LGBT, and so that also sort of firmly aligned me with the Democrats for the time being. And I know there are some young Republicans that are sort of letting go of that as an issue, but I remember very distinctly in 2004 when I lived in D.C. that they were using it as an issue to try to drive people apart. And now that the tides have turned, there's a lot of people that are pretending like it never happened. But I was there in 2004. I remember them using it to bash Democrats over the head.
Yeah, so you must have a very personal reaction to the recent decision nullifying Alaska's ban on same-sex marriage.
I do. And, in some ways, the necessity of that, actually in many ways, the necessity of that decision is unfortunate. I wish we had the opportunity to, as voters or as our elected representatives, overturn that ban. I wish we had done it ourselves through a democratic process. However, there was no indication we were going to do that. I'm sure you remember here last year when the House Republicans were asked, would you consider same-sex, even civil unions? And they sort of burst out laughing. So it was clear that it wasn't going to get through the legislature anytime soon. And it wasn't on the ballot box. So, I wouldn't ask people who've been in committed relationships for decades in some cases to delay putting off this important moment in their life just because we haven't gotten around to doing it yet. So I supported that decision. I'm a little bit surprised of the stay that was issued recently. I think that'll probably get resolved. The writing is on the wall. I mean, if you read the Windsor case, if you followed the progress of what was the Schwarzenegger case and now has a different name out of California, it was very clear at every level that there was no harm that could be identified by the defendants. The people that were in favor of the ban couldn't identify a single appreciable harm to any member of the public. And you can't really have a law. You can't justify a law that harms a group with absolutely no reason. You have to have at least a rational basis and probably a heightened level of scrutiny. And it couldn't even pass rational basis, which really speaks to how sort of one-sided it's been in the courts.
All right. So your campaign started out with like, I mean, I remember seeing this goofy video of you.
Sure.
That was my first exposure to Forrest Dunbar.
Yeah.
Have you felt it gaining traction, or have you felt like yourself being taken more seriously, for lack of a better word?
Absolutely. I got out of, I started the campaign last September, but we suspended it for 4.5 months because I went on active duty with the Army Guard. And as you probably know, you can't campaign and be on duty at the same time. So we suspended the campaign. And then when I got off of active duty and I came back to Alaska in late February, I hired a campaign manager and we really hit the ground running. Had an event in Cordova, had an event in Anchorage. But I wanted to run a campaign that was a little bit more positive, a little bit more fun. And I needed a way to, without too much money, break through and get people to notice me. And so hence the kind of funny video. And that was very well received. And since then, we've released a couple more. But as you sort of alluded to, we've also sort of been more serious as well. I mean, things have been shifting. So we won the primary in August. And then another watershed moment was the Kodiak fisheries debate, where I think people realized that I understand policy and I care about policy, particularly fisheries policy. And there were some other reasons that debate kind of went our way. And since then, we've had a large increase in funding. And we've also been, we've been up on the radio in a variety of markets. And we've been doing a lot of sort of traditional campaign work in addition to the more fun social media stuff we've done as well.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are your big policy focuses besides fisheries?
So I see the central challenge for my generation, and it's a multi-generational challenge, but it's squarely in front of my generation, which is the millennials, people in their late 20s, early 30s. The question is, where are the good-paying jobs of the future going to come from? There might be enough. There probably are enough oil and gas jobs to last me until I retire and my generation until we retire. And certainly oil and gas is going to continue being a huge part of our economy, and I'm very much in favor of oil and gas development. That's somewhere that Don Young and I see eye to eye. However, there's no question that if I want my children and my grandchildren to live in this state, we have to find other sources of jobs. That means tourism. It means sustainable fisheries. It means high tech. These are going to be the sources of jobs in the future. So how do we find new markets, new industries, and how do we create more value added here in the state? We're not just going to be a resource extraction state. That's a big part of it. But we've seen that when we create more value here in the state before we export it, that leads to better longer-term jobs. I also believe that it'll help, as we diversify our economy, it'll help reverse our brain drain. So as you know, we have a lot of people who leave Alaska and never come back. And I want to be able to recruit and retain young families here in the state. So that means good jobs. It also means a world-class education system because people want to put their kids into a good school. That to me is the central challenge. Now, we talk about other things as well. I'm passionate about veterans policy. I myself serve in the Army National Guard. And we have a huge veteran community here in Alaska. The good news is that we've been a pioneer in delivering healthcare services to rural communities using compacts between the VA and particularly Native hospitals, but other hospitals as well, to allow them to be reimbursed. That's a very positive program, but we can do more there. The last thing we talked about, and we talked about a lot in the beginning of the campaign, and people bring it up a little bit less now, although it's incredibly crucial, is campaign finance reform. The way that we finance our campaigns, the way that things work in D.C. Is very problematic. And frankly, it's harmful to our democracy. It's also why I came out strongly in favor of term limits. And I'm one of the relatively few people on my side of the aisle that's done that. I came out in favor of term limits on the federal level because I think it's very much a campaign finance issue where staffers and ex-Congress people are being recruited onto K Street. We can't seem to stop that revolving door between the lobbying firms that provide campaign donations and the Hill. So my idea was to use term limits to sort of clog that door with a flood of bodies, lower the individual value of each of one of those people, and thus reduce the appeal of the lobbying profession. So that's a long answer, but those are some of the things we care about.
On campaign finance, do you mean specifically Citizens United, or is it something more endemic than that?
Citizens United exacerbated problems that were already there. Citizens United made things, and you can capture this, and there have been studies that show this, have made things much worse. There's no question. But we were in a pretty bad place even before that. There are people who want to amend the U.S. Constitution to repeal Citizens United. I certainly support those efforts, but I don't believe it. So first of all, it's incredibly difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution, as everybody knows. We've only done it 27 times in our history, and 10 of those times were right at the beginning, right? It's incredibly difficult. So while we might get to that point, and I hope there is that kind of grassroots movement, there are things we can do before then to make things better. The first thing to do would be to appoint Supreme Court justices that are originalist, because there's nothing originalist about Citizens United. Our founders and the people who ratified the First Amendment had no conception of that kind of corporatist free speech ideology. And that's why I also signed the Alaska We the People Constitution Pledge, which also recognizes the Alaska Constitution also creates individual rights for human beings, not for corporations. Now, even before that, before we appoint those new Supreme Court justices that are originalist, we can also pass statutes within the current structure that the Supreme Court has created that can make things better. The best example was what's called Patriot Dollars. It's an idea forwarded by Lawrence Lessig, who is a professor from Harvard, and there have been a number of there's already a bill on the House floor actually about it that would basically create a voucher program. I know voucher is kind of a dirty word, but in this case, it would create a voucher program where every American citizen would get a certain amount of money, but they could only use it. They could only use it for donations to political campaigns and political candidates. And you'd use the jurisprudence of the court as it stands now to sort of filter the money through individuals, which is an important precedent for them. And we would choose as people who we wanted to support. So it's a little bit less top-down than traditional public finance, but it would also get us closer to that one person, one vote ideal in finance as well as in our voting.
Yeah. And as far as, you know, your campaign finance,
yeah,
where's your money been coming from?
It's been coming almost exclusively from individual small contributions. And maybe that's why an idea like that is so appealing to me. I haven't gotten the huge sort of piles of corporate lobbyist cash that my opponent has. So, you know, over the summer, we haven't released, I haven't seen the most recent, his most recent FEC report. But the last one that was released, we had 306 individual Alaskan contributors, which was about, I think, between 80 and 85% of our total campaign contributions. He had 33, right, which was less than 20% of his total contributions. So it is kind of remarkable learning where this money comes from. His money comes primarily from Northern Virginia, which is really just lobbyists coming from somewhere else. A lot of money from New York, Texas, Florida. We get our money mostly from Alaska, and then I get some from my personal network that I developed, you know, at my grad school, at my law school, my family, that's extended family that lives out of state, some of them. So I have, but it's been almost exclusively individual contributions.
And This American Life and Planet Money, they've done some reporting on what that machine looks like in D.C., you know, congresspeople walking across the street and then spending 2 hours a day or 4 hours a day just cold calling people and raising money. If you're elected, do you find yourself, hold yourself to term limits so you wouldn't have to worry about that, or, you know, what?
No, I'm not going to unilaterally harm Alaska in that way. I'm going to play in the rules of the game as established. I want to change those rules. I want to change that structure. And currently, and certainly our current congressman is kind of the poster child for why people think we need term limits, because of the power of incumbency, because it allows you to raise so much money, because you become so disconnected from your home district, especially when it's a large district like this, and you get this sense of entitlement of this is my seat, this isn't really the state's seat, and that's why I support term limits. It's also why I support campaign finance, so perhaps you wouldn't have to spend 2 to 4 hours a day. Actually, I've heard it's 4 to 6 hours a day, but whatever it is, it's a long time making those calls. Now, the fact that you have to make those calls is why lobbyists have so much power in D.C., because they can slide up to somebody like Don Young and say, you know what, why don't you take this afternoon off, and I will bundle you $10,000 or $50,000 or whatever it is, and we'll put that in your campaign, and you know, don't worry about it. And that's very appealing, because nobody really wants to be cold calling 4 to 6 hours a day, or 2 to 4 hours a day, or whatever it is. So I would be pushing for term limits. I'd be pushing for campaign finance. But in the short to medium term, I'm not going to unilaterally do that if it's going to harm the state. We want to set up a new structure where the state could be more influential. I will say that Don Young has been sort of playing under the old rules. Unfortunately, it kind of went haywire in 2007, 2008, when he was caught with his ethics violations. And now his years of seniority are the least valuable years of seniority in the U.S. House. I mean, he holds no leadership positions. He chairs no full committees. He's not really the force he once was because of his ethics violations.
But there are still a lot of people in Alaska who, for whatever reason, feel like Don Young just gets things done. So, are you finding that that's changing? Or
I certainly believe it is changing. But this gets back to why we need term limits, because D.C. is far away, literally and figuratively. It's far away from Alaska. It can be very difficult to figure out what's happening there. So, I'm fortunate to have a network there, and I speak with people, and they're like, he's no longer powerful. He's no longer influential, but he maintains that facade here in Alaska, primarily because he has a lot of money with to do so, and he has 100% name recognition. But I do think people are starting to realize that for a variety of reasons, we could do better as a state.
Can I take it back just for a second to what you said about the economy and creating that next generation of jobs?
Yeah.
How much can Congress or government really do to help that along, do you think?
Well, I think building critical infrastructure is certainly a big part of that. Developing high-speed internet, especially in rural areas in Alaska. I mean, the federal government spent $100 million running fiber optics to rural Alaska. And hopefully we'll start to see some benefit out of that. I think we already have, actually. So that's certainly a place they can do so. I think in the case of Alaska, there's going to need to be some more cooperation on federal lands and in some cases a change in the regulations. Another thing we can do is provide – I mean, I go all over the state all the time. I've been from Ketchikan to Unalaska to Kotzebue to Barrow. And almost everywhere I go, I speak with a variety of different nonprofit and for-profit organizations. And they talk about federal grants that they're receiving, or in the case of Alaska Native companies, corporations, 8A contracts they're receiving. So there's no question that federal funds have led to jobs here in Alaska. It's undeniable. Some of those are sort of specific to Alaska. Some of those are based on national policy. The fact that we have a number of very large military bases here creates jobs. The fact that we're going to hopefully, and it looks like it's going to happen, put more Coast Guard resources into Alaska. I believe one or two cutters will be coming to Juneau, in fact, another one in Ketchikan, and we'll probably see some more resources in Kodiak as well. As the Arctic starts to open, we're going to need to have a larger Coast Guard presence here to protect those shipping lanes and to have spill response if we do develop the shell and offshore. So there's absolutely a role for federal government to play. Now, a lot of times that means getting them out of the way, but sometimes it means getting their input and their resources for things like infrastructure and other programs. And we're a young state. We still lack some of the infrastructure the federal government helped build in other states 50 years ago. So I don't have any of these qualms about, oh, well, we're anti-federal government, but we also ask for money for them. That's not in conflict in this case. The federal government owns between 60 and 68% of Alaskan land. They're going to be heavily invested here, and they should be.
All right. A question about earmarks. Where do you stand?
Well, earmarks are largely dead as they were traditionally known. There are still ways to appropriate specific funds. And there are projects in Alaska that have been funded essentially through those kind of direct appropriations. There are a variety of centers and roads and bridges. So I'm not sort of opposed to the idea of the federal government deciding that – or the congressional delegation going to the federal government and say, hey, we want to build this project. Now, I will say that there was a time when Alaskans, we as Alaskans probably weren't careful enough about what we were asking for. And so we'd get projects that didn't make a lot of sense. Probably the most famous example might be the road in Ketchikan that goes to where the bridge would have started, but there's no bridge there. So it's just a road that goes to a cliff and then it just ends, right? And that's a little bit silly because now we have to pay to maintain that road and it doesn't actually go anywhere, right? So projects like that we have to be very careful about. And the days of sort of milk and honey or what have you, those are gone. We know those are gone regardless of who the congressperson is. We are not going to be able to get those kind of projects. So we have to be a lot smarter about what we're specifically asking for if we have the resources to maintain it. And if that is the case, I mean, there are certainly many critical projects I still want to see funded.
Well, that hits pretty close to home because the Federal Highway Administration is funding something like $100 or $200 million towards a road to the Katsahine River near Haines out of Juneau. I don't know. Is that the kind of project you'd be looking out for? And as a congressperson, would you,
You know, for me, and this is, we'll talk about the Juneau Access Road, right? A different road. But the Juneau Access Road, the road to Ambler, those are examples of roads where, first and foremost, we have to be looking at, does the local community want it? To me, that is the central issue. And so talk to the people in Haines. Do they want that road? Do they not want that road? I grew up in Cordova where they proposed building a hugely expensive road, and the people in the city fought it for a variety of reasons, and it didn't get built. And look, in retrospect, thank God we didn't build it, because now one of the bridges that would have been needed to use the road has been declared structurally unsound and would take hundreds of millions of dollars to repair, in addition to the how much it would take to maintain that road. So there are certainly road projects I support. But for me, it's about looking at the community. Does the community want it? Does the community say they need it? And that's where you should go as a congressperson first and foremost. Make sure that you have local buy-in for a project. And then you can go ahead with it.
So something like the Eisenbeck.
Yes, that's a great example. So thank you for bringing that up. I support that very strongly, as does every member of the delegation. And again, that's a good example of a lot of these issues aren't Democrat or Republican. They're not left, right. They're Alaskan issues, first and foremost. And whether you're Democrat or Republican, you'll fight for them in D.C. If there are rational arguments for why we need them, that community wants that road. That road could save lives. And that road, by the way, isn't a we're not talking about an 8-lane superhighway. We're talking about basically a dirt road, or perhaps it'll be paved. I don't think it will be, actually. But single lane, or just a little bit larger than single lane, but a critical life-saving road.
One of the biggest federal issues in recent years for Southeast Alaska has been the Sea Alaska Land Selection Bill.
Yeah.
And Congressman Young's been, faithfully reintroducing that bill every session since, do you take a different approach to that, or are you against it?
I'm certainly not against the bill. And I think Don Young and I also agree on a lot of issues relative to Alaska Native people. The biggest one we differ on is the Pebble Mine, which is related to Alaska Natives, but also to more broadly everyone in Alaska. I'm very much opposed to the Pebble Mine. He hasn't said he's opposed to it, and he's supported legislation that would help it go forward. But getting back to your original question, I would absolutely fight for that bill. I'd say the biggest difference between me and Congressman Young is our interpersonal styles and our approach here. There was a time when he was very powerful. He was the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. He was the chair of the Transportation Committee. And he could sort of beat people over the head with his club. And so he had this very aggressive, almost bombastic approach. The problem is he's kept that approach, but he doesn't have the power anymore. And people in D.C. know he doesn't have the power anymore. For the last 6 years, he has lost that power. And he'll say it's because of term limits. We say it's because of, well, there aren't actually officially term limits. That's his own party's rules, and they basically don't want him to chair committees. But the point is this. That is a counterproductive approach. If you are berating and belittling people on TV and they know you don't have the influence to actually get things done, that's counterproductive. So I would support those kind of bills, but I would take a different approach that's a little more collaborative, that works across the aisle, that works with the administration. And I'm just not a fan of belittling people on TV. I just think it doesn't work. If it worked, I wouldn't have such a problem with it. It might be rude or whatnot, but that's fine if it works. But it doesn't work. We've seen in the last 6 years it doesn't. You keep saying he's reintroducing these bills, but a lot of them don't go anywhere. If there's any kind of controversy at all, they don't go anywhere because he doesn't have the ability to influence people anymore.
You brought up Pebble Mine, and here in Southeast, a big issue right now is transboundary mines.
Yes, KSM.
Yep.
And others.
So how would you work with the federal government on those issues and trying to make sure that those mines aren't going to harm Alaska fisheries?
Sure. It's a very important issue. And it's somewhere where the delegation is unified. They've sent letters to the State Department. There's no particular controversy here. Again, it's not a Democrat or a Republican issue in terms of Alaskans wanting to stop this mine. Now, how we actually do that is a difficult question because Canada is a sovereign nation, and they don't always have to listen to us. It's a very big problem. And Canada can also point to a number of treaties that we signed having to do with fish and other things and say, hey, you've been in violation of these for years. And it does look like the administration in Canada is going forward with some of these projects. Now, there is a panel review I'm sure you're familiar with. For some reason, our governor didn't ask for panel review, which is a strange move on his part. But at the end of the day, he's not the head of that province and he's not the premier of Canada. So it really has to go through the State Department. We have to work aggressively with the State Department to try to get Canada to understand this is a first order priority for us. Whenever the United States meets with Canada, I want that to be on the table. And my sort of in my former life, I had considered becoming a foreign service officer. I kind of went pretty far down that path. When I was working in the Congresswoman's office, I was involved in sort of preliminary negotiations dealing with the ambassador from Japan, having to do with moving Marines out of Japan to Guam. And so I have a little bit of familiarity with that world. And it's a world that moves at a glacial pace. It's a world where you have to have good interpersonal skills. And it's a world where, frankly, in some cases, it's going to be hard to get leverage over Canada to get them to stop. But it's going to be a first-order priority for the delegation going forward because those mines pose a huge threat to our fish. I mean, we just saw what happened with Mount Pawley, right? And if you had gone to the owner of Mount Pawley the day before that dam burst, I guarantee you they would have told you there's a 0% chance of it breaking, that it is structurally sound, that there's no chance. And I've been in meetings with people that represent Pebble, and they say basically the same thing. That it's so high, it's so long, it's miles and miles of, and there's no way this tailing dam would burst. But the same contractor that was going to build that dam built the Mount Pawley Dam. So we have to be extremely careful with these projects. And I'm not opposed to mining more generally, but I'm not willing to risk the fish in specific cases.
Yeah, well, so if you're not opposed to mining more generally, here in Juneau we have two large gold mines and silver mine. And employ a lot of people in town.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a lot of other proposals out there for mines around Southeast Alaska, especially in the Tongass.
Yep.
What do you do to support those projects? Make sure that they're safe again.
Yeah. So in some cases, you'll directly support them. In some cases, it makes sense to just sort of stay out and let things progress. I think the role is if there is a mining project that appears to be safe and being done the right way, and there certainly are those, and they're getting pushback from regulators in an unreasonable way, that's when they will come to, or I will go to them, the congressperson will help put pressure on those regulatory agencies. This is, again, why Don Young is no longer effective, because he's burned so many bridges with those agencies. I mean, he's constantly, everything is the end of the world. Every regulation is so devastating, our economy is going to cease to function. And at some point, you're the boy who cried wolf. And those agencies no longer trust your opinion when it comes to different regulations. So there are certainly a lot of regulations that are counter to the interests of Alaska, that are unreasonable, that aren't based on science, and we should fight those. But he paints with such a broad brush that he's lost credibility. So when you go into those agencies and there's a genuine concern, they're much less likely to listen to him. That's why we need a new approach.
Since we're on kind of resource extraction, the Tongass is, also there's a lot of people, who would like to go back to the days of, logging.
Right.
But I don't know that we're going to get back to that point. I think we're now beyond, we're into, I think the Forest Service wants to go to second growth and those sorts of ideas. How do you work with the different factions in the Tongass to get, something that's good for the communities and good for the industry?
Absolutely. I think the sort of very broad roadless rule is something that I'm opposed to. But in specific cases, it does look like the old timber industry in Alaska, in the Tongass, is not really economical anymore. If you let the free market work without any kind of subsidy, it's not clear that it actually would be competitive. That being said, I support the Bighorn sale, and I want to keep that mill open. But I think the future is going to be in not just in second growth, but also in smaller operations where you're doing a lot of value added. That is really the future for Alaskan forestry, where we're producing products before we export them, as opposed to simply exporting the raw timber, the logs. That appears to be more economical. There might also be an industry in wood pellets. I know that some facilities in Haines and other places have gone to wood pellet boilers for heat, and that might also be a source of jobs in the future. So in general, I'm supportive of having a timber industry, but I think you're right. I think the timber industry is going to look differently in the future than it looked 50 years ago.
All right.
You know, that's interesting that you said you support the Bighorn, but want the value added jobs, because I think that was one of the issues that SEAC had, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council had with the Bighorn sale.
Right.
Was they were something like there was some ratio of local hire or something that would.
Well, I'm not familiar with the local hire specifically, but I know, I mean, it's very clearly designed to keep Viking open, right? And Viking is the last of the large mills down in the region. And I think SEAC believes, and a lot of people believe, that the future is not with Viking, the future is with the smaller producers. But I don't think it's necessarily one is mutually exclusive with the other. There are going to be some cases where we can have sales that keep Viking afloat, and there are some other ones where it'll be smaller bore. I think the Bighorn in particular is meant as transition. We're trying to transition to second growth, but it's going to take a while, and we need something to keep them afloat until that happens. So that's why I support the sale.
And when you say you're against the broad roadless rule, do you support some variation of the roadless rule, or are you just against that specific?
I just don't like the idea of the federal government locking up huge swaths of Alaska without really doing the proper local consultation. And it's not just in the Tongass. There are large pieces of land. The federal government owns more land in Alaska than any other state. It owns a higher percentage of land in Alaska than every state except Nevada. And it's by far the largest landowner in Alaska. And when things like the FLTMA, I'm trying to remember what that acronym stands for, the Federal Land Policy Management Act. When that passed, the idea was that there would be management plans that took into account that people live here and that we need jobs and that we need to develop some of it. We weren't just going to lock things up and throw away the key. But unfortunately, with some federal lands, that appears to be the case. And that's something that I think Alaskans of all different political types and all over the state rightly push back against. It's just too large a piece of land to lock up forever.
All right. Switching gears, one of the big things in the state is healthcare.
Sure.
And the governor has refused to expand Medicaid. I'm sure you're for that.
I am. As are most Alaskans, as is the Chamber of Commerce, as is people from both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah. So are there things you would change about the healthcare law, though? Or Mark Begich is now campaigning on that law, but saying he'll change parts of it, work to change
absolutely
parts of it.
So let me just first, before we move on to that, I want to say something about the previous question.
Sure.
I don't want to give the impression that I want to just clear cut and bulldoze everything, because tourism is a hugely important part of our industry here, but also because things like subsistence are very important, and because the state as a whole, I mean, you won't meet many better environmentalists than people who want to maintain the fish stocks, right? So I don't want to give that impression, but there is a way to manage things with science that's more in the middle. So going on to healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, there's no question that there are flaws. There's no question that there are amendments that need to be made, and we're going to try to do that. But the heart of the act is people with pre-existing conditions can no longer be discriminated against by insurers. That impacts millions of people. That and the Medicaid expansion. But let's focus on that other thing. When I left law school, I lost my student health insurance. And like a lot of people in my generation, my employer didn't actually offer health insurance. And so I went out into the private market, and I turns out I have a pre-existing condition. I didn't realize it till I started to apply for quote-unquote private health insurance. This was before the Affordable Care Act went into effect. And I was rejected by everyone. I called the hotline. I tried to get insurance. Eventually, I ended up in a state-run high-risk pool called ACHIA. It was $250 a month with a $10,000 deductible and no basically catastrophic only, no preventative care. It was not good insurance, and it was not sustainable. As I've said before, I had to get hit by a bus in just the right way for it to be useful for me.
That was here?
That was here in Alaska. So this ACHIA, it was A-C-H-I-A. It was a state-run program. I think it was managed out of Kansas or Nebraska. It was a high-risk pool for people that had pre-existing conditions. And my pre-existing condition was connected to a sports injury I had suffered. Ironically, 2 years later, I was in the Army and getting, good scores on the physical fitness test. And so I get my health care now through the military, through the Army Guard. But if I didn't, I would have to be on those exchanges. And so I hear John Young, I hear Dan Sullivan talk about, we're going to repeal Obamacare. They call it Obamacare, not the Affordable Care Act. We're going to repeal this thing. And when I ask, well, what's going to happen to those millions of people and tens of thousands of Alaskans with pre-existing conditions? And they have no alternative. Sometimes they said, oh, well, they can buy into Medicaid or Medicare. And that to me is remarkable. So the solution is single payer. I didn't know that was where we were going ahead. But the point is, whatever reform we do needs to preserve that center of the act, that people with pre-existing conditions cannot be discriminated against anymore by insurance companies. Because the system we had before, and I was a 27-year-old non-smoker at the time when I was rejected. I can only imagine how hard it is for someone who's in their 50s or 60s, but not old enough for Medicare, who had cancer, for example. There's no way they're going to be able to get private insurance if we do the repeal programs that Don Young and Dan Sullivan support.
Any specific areas that you would change from the law?
It's a very large and complicated law. There are some things specific to Congress that need to be changed. I think the mandate, the way it functions, might need to be changed. And we have to have, as we've seen, we have to have even tougher controls on the health insurance companies increasing the prices. We allowed the state, we sort of devolved that to the states. And some states did a very good job of tightly regulating cost increases among these insurers. Some states did a very poor job. And it just so happens Alaska was rated the poorest by the Kaiser Medical, the Kaiser Foundation, which does a lot of nonpartisan research. They found that we had either the worst or among the worst regulatory agencies set up by Parnell, where they didn't take advantage of the federal funds that were available, and they didn't do any kind of meaningful oversight to stop this growth of the health insurance inflation. And I'll say one last thing on this, and it's a really big issue that impacts both state and federal policymakers and local policymakers, that a portion of the cost growth in health insurance is related to the cost growth in healthcare provision. There's an underlying cost growth there that has become unsustainable. So in places like Anchorage, but also, of course, out in the rural areas, it's just phenomenally expensive to get even routine procedures done. And we have to be talking as a state more seriously about how we get that under control.
On the different referendums, the different yes. ballot questions this year, SB 21, how'd you vote?
I voted yes.
For the repeal?
For the repeal.
Okay.
But I'll say now that we're past it, it is the law of the land. We're going to work within it. But I voted yes at the time because I felt it was too big a risk for the state. It might be working now. Maybe we are getting more money out of it now. And that's great it's not great because it means the prices of oil have gone down. But at the time, I felt there was no protection for the state. There was no sunset provision. There was no escrow account. There was nothing that shifted the risk in any way. It was basically a shift of risk from the oil companies to the state. We took a gamble. And maybe it'll pay off. But I still felt it was a poorly written bill. So that's why I voted yes.
Okay. And the upcoming ballot questions. Crystal Bay.
Yeah, I'm yes. I'm yes, which means I'm opposed to the Pebble Mine.
Okay. On minimum wage.
I'm a strong yes, as are a very large majority of Alaskans.
And legalizing pot.
I am the only statewide candidate from Democrat or Republican that supports that initiative. I'm a yes vote there. And there are people on the no side I respect, people like Bill Walker, people like Mark Begich. But I disagree, and I think it's largely a generational issue. You know, I'm a bit younger than anyone else who's running statewide right now, and my generation grew up with drugs and alcohol in our communities. I grew up in Eagle and Cordova. It matters very much to me that the ballot measure is written in such a flexible way that small towns can choose whether or not to allow the sale of marijuana in their towns. But I grew up around drugs and alcohol, and I saw so many issues growing up, and when I worked in criminal justice as well, violent crimes and driving fatalities and all the rest, and none of them were related to marijuana. It was usually alcohol. Sometimes it was, you know, meth or prescription drugs. It was never marijuana, and that to me has always struck me that you know. And I tour breweries and I enjoy a beer from now and then. I'm not trying to say that we need to prohibit alcohol, because we tried that once and it was a hugely expensive failure. And I believe our current marijuana policy is also a hugely expensive failure. And the last thing I'll say on that, actually, I could talk about this forever, but the idea that we're going to create an industry that doesn't exist in marijuana in Alaska right now is not true. There is a huge marijuana industry in Alaska right now. It's just in the black market. We have the highest usage rates in the country, or among the highest usage rates. I was in high school in Alaska not too long ago. Believe me, you can get marijuana. You can get marijuana easily. So we want to bring some of that out of the shadows, regulate it in such a way where we know what's in the substance, and get some tax revenue, which we can use for education, law enforcement, and treatment, all of which are proven more effective to actually reduce drug use than prison time. So, yes, I support the ballot initiative.
But that also leaves open the federal-state mismatch issue on
absolutely.
Do you see doing anything on the federal level?
Sure. So this is somewhere, again, Don Young and I agree. And I feel like I've been saying that a lot today. But Don Young has stated, and I wholeheartedly agree, that if the state legalizes, we should do everything it takes to keep the federal government from interfering, make sure the DEA isn't shutting down legitimate businesses, making sure the banking regulations are changed in such a way where we don't have to have things kept in cash and gold doubloons or whatever they're doing that we can use. That we can use the banking system. And I do believe that we're going to move that way pretty quickly, because we've seen what's happening in Colorado and Washington State. And, you know, there have been some sort of misinformation out there about the sky is falling. You know, it's just been this disaster. It's not the case at all. A majority of people in those states would vote again to do this. And if you go there, you see it's there are certainly regulatory issues that need to be worked out, like, for example, the federal-state mismatch you just mentioned. But in general, it's working well, and it's providing tax revenues for critical services.
Okay. Army National Guard, I was kind of curious. Anchorage Press just had a big, you know, they got the leaked investigation reports from the sexual misconduct stuff. They reported rampant sexual assaults or culture of fear, all that. Just wondering, what's your experience been in the Army National Guard?
I'm relatively new to the Army Guard.
How long have you been?
I've been in a little over a year. I commissioned. It took me a while, partially because of those health issues. I had to get a health waiver, and it took me a little while to get into the Guard. I was trying to get in for quite a while. And partially just because I'm a JAG officer, and it can be difficult to get, which is an attorney for the Guard, essentially. So I sort of don't have any firsthand knowledge of what they're talking about, except for I am now working some of those cases. So I can't really talk about the specifics for that reason. I can say that in the last year or so, I do think a lot of those prosecutions are going forward. But I've read some of those reports. It's funny, I actually called up the Anchorage Press this morning. I called up that article, but I didn't get a chance to read it. I was running out the door. I'm going to read it here shortly. But I believe what I suspect it will say is that there was some very serious problems in the Guard that went ignored, and that does appear to be the case. Now, I don't want to assign specific blame, and in some of those cases, I might be involved in prosecutions of some of those individuals. But in general, it does look like there were some very serious issues in the Guard that went undealt with for a very long time. And ultimately, we have a very strong governor here in the state. We've set up a system where, and this is actually something I'd like to see changed eventually. I'd like to see other centers of power, elected commissioners or something along those lines. But right now, everything in Alaska stops with the governor. The buck stops with the governor. And ultimately, he is responsible. And he should have taken, I believe he should have taken stronger action. And I think he would actually say that too at this point. Looking at what happened, I think he has some regrets there as well. But the buck in Alaska, because of the system we have, the buck always stops with the governor.
All right. Who are you voting for governor?
I'll be voting for the unity ticket. And I supported Byron Mallott earlier in the campaign. But because I was traveling around the state, you're at the same fairs, you're at the same parades. And so I met almost everyone who was running for the statewide offices. And I got to know Bill Walker. I knew him a little bit before that even, but I got to know him a little bit better. And he's just very impressive. He's got the background in oil and gas. He understands that industry. He was the mayor of Valdez. I was just in Valdez this past weekend. And the first thing you see when you come out of the airport is a big Bill Walker sign. I mean, they like him there, and that always I think speaks volume. When you go back to the hometown of a politician where they were the mayor or they were the state house rep, how are they seen? How are they supported? And Bill Walker has tremendous support in Valdez, and so for that reason, and because bringing it back to the earlier conversation, he said that he will accept that Medicaid expansion on day one, and I believe him. And that would be a huge benefit to tens of thousands of Alaskans. It would also create a lot of jobs here in the state. So that alone to me is enough of a reason to switch governors.
You're 29 years old?
I just turned 30. Okay. It was a big milestone, a little bit depressing. I turned 30, I think it was about 4 weeks ago.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
So has Don Young literally been your congressman your entire life?
Yes. I've been an Alaskan my whole life, and he has been the congressman that entire time.
And have you voted for him in the past?
No. No, I haven't. I have voted for Republicans in the past, but not him. And it's funny, when I met him for the first time in 2006, actually I met him before that, I met him in 2002, but when I was in D.C., and it was a relatively small community of Alaskans in D.C., and so I met him a number of times. He was always perfectly nice to me, perfectly polite, had no personal animosity towards him when I started to run. But during the course of this campaign, I've realized that sort of the legend is true, and I think in the last 6 years in particular, he's become much more. His behavior has gotten stranger. He's gotten a little bit angrier, and now it's a different situation than when I knew him or when I met him in 2006. Mm-hmm. So he's just very different than he was back then.
And the press has made some hay of you personally encountering that at least once.
Yes, and that reporter and a number of other people as well asked me to comment on the record, and initially I wasn't going to. I just wasn't really comfortable with it. But they kept asking. The truth is, we alluded to it on stage. People knew something had happened, and I felt it was important to get that story out there. And there was a witness as well that corroborated most of it. So I can say that, from my memory, that is what happened. That story was basically accurately reported. The only thing that I take issue with that story is they described me as stocky, which is I've never been described as stocky. That's a new one for me. But other than that, that story is essentially what happened. And it was an unpleasant experience, I have to say. But it wasn't, I have to point out, I never felt threatened in any serious way. I mean, he's actually going to do anything. And I was never actually worried. I mean, it was fine. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have. Jeremy?
Okay. I've run out now, too. Yep.
Anything else that you want to add? That's the...
No, I guess I could just say it's wonderful to be back here in Juneau. I've been here, I think, 4 or 5 times, maybe even 6, during the course of this campaign. I've always had a great time when I'm here. I'm on my way to Sitka to go be in the Alaska Day Parade. I love Southeast. It feels similar in a lot of ways to where I grew up in Cordova. The weather is quite similar. It looks very similar. I guess the biggest difference is you guys have tourism, a lot more tourism than we do. So, and you also have obviously the capital here. But again, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here in Southeast.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Forrest.